This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, April 9th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. 2 weeks ago, Congress passed the biggest stimulus bill in American history to address the devastation the coronavirus is bringing to workers and the economy. It will send $2 trillion to the unemployed, businesses, and medical providers. Despite the size of the bill, economists and infectious disease specialists mostly agree that it is not enough. And members of Congress are discussing a second bill that would authorize another $250 billion in aid to small businesses. The administration, though, continues to push to reopen the economy as soon as possible. Larry Kudlow, Trump's most publicly accessible economic advisor, told Politico this week that it could be as soon as the next 4 to 8 weeks. On Fox News, he said that once the economy does reopen, it'll be in great shape.
Don't forget, Brian, we had a roaring economy coming into this new year, 2020, in January and February. We were growing at better than 3% at an annual rate. And please don't also forget, even though it seems a long time ago, President Trump's policies to rebuild the economy on lower taxes and regulations and better trade deals and energy independence, all that stuff was working beautifully. I think we can pick up where we left off. I am hoping, as I say, praying that we're only a few weeks away from a reopening. We'll see.
John Cassidy, a staff writer at The New Yorker, joins me to talk about how the pandemic is exposing the fault lines in Trumponomics and the lessons from history and from other nations now about how best to respond to pandemics and how to stave off a Great Depression. John, welcome back.
Thanks, Dorothy. Thanks for inviting me on.
Most of us, except for the most elderly of us, haven't ever experienced an economic crisis of this scale. Public officials have been calling it a war to convey the need to address it as aggressively as possible. But it's really a public health crisis and an economic catastrophe. Health authorities compare it to the flu pandemic of 1918, and economists, you among them, invoke the Great Depression. Could you talk a little bit about those analogies and how they hold up?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's shaping up as a sort of combination, really, of the Great Flu of 1918 and the sometimes referred to as the Spanish Flu and the Great Depression. Although, as you say, it's really sui generis. We've never before had a pandemic like this, which has produced a policy to basically, we've taken a policy decision to put the economy into a deep recession, a very necessary decision, because we want to save people's lives, obviously. So the policy of sort of locking down people inevitably involves locking down large sections of the economy. So in the last few weeks, we've seen 17 million people apply for unemployment benefits. If you look at that on its face, it looks a lot worse than the Great Depression. The Great Depression took 3 or 4 years to reach its height. This thing's only taken 3 or 4 weeks. So if you just look at it on its face, that looks like an absolute catastrophe. And all the policy reactions, everybody talks about a stimulus, but really what we're trying to do here is keep the economy and keep people and keep businesses on some form of sort of financial life support until we get a grip on the virus. Usually a very severe recession is basically an economic collapse where the policymakers have completely lost control of the situation. So far here, that hasn't happened. As I say, what we're seeing is basically a result of a sort of political and social decision of how to deal with the virus.
And what about the pandemic of 1918? As I understand it, there wasn't a recession afterward, although retail sales, of course, went down.
Yes, I mean, it was a different example, because although individual cities like St. Louis and Philadelphia and New York did at various stages introduce sort of social distancing measures and closing public meetings down, etc., there was no effort to basically tell the entire workforce or large swaths of it to stay at home and not go to work anymore. We've reacted much more aggressively to this virus than we did to that one. We knew what we're dealing with, and we've reacted in a more, economically anyway, a more comprehensive way. Obviously, the public health reaction has been pretty atrocious in lots of ways.
And in the Great Depression, Hoover didn't handle it particularly well. FDR brought a completely different approach when he came into office. and using both fiscal and monetary policies, as well as strategic interventions in specific industries to restart the whole economy.
Yeah, well, what happened basically in the early 30s was we had a stock market crash in 1929, and then that was succeeded by a banking crisis. Consumer spending collapsed, and businesses defaulted on a lot of their bank loans. A lot of the banks got into serious trouble. Then people started trying to take their money out of the banks because there was no deposit insurance in those days. And then we had a full-blown financial panic and collapse with banks closing all over the country. Hoover, who was a sort of, you know, pro-business Republican, took the attitude that we could only really rely on voluntarism, and sort of he did scale up government spending to a small extent on public works, but he was also still dedicated to balancing the budgets and that businesses could get us out of this. So there was no comprehensive use of what's now called fiscal policy, government spending, and monetary policy of the Federal Reserve to pull us through until Roosevelt came into office in 1932. And the first thing he did was shut down the banking system and the financial markets for a couple of weeks, declared a bank holiday. And during that period, he put together a sort of comprehensive financial rescue package, which included deposit insurance so people would stop trying to get their money out of the bank. He also introduced various sort of new agencies to try and get the economy going, including when I wrote about the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which was basically a big government lending agency which took stakes in troubled banks and troubled railroads, a bit like what we're doing now, but it had never been done before then. And that did restore, it didn't turn the economy around instantly, but it restored confidence in the financial markets. It stopped the downward spiral, and things gradually got better from there on.
So all of this does help to explain how Trumponomics has been failing, which is really a form of Reaganomics, which is really a form of what Hoover originally attempted to do.
Trumponomics, Reaganomics really applies to the first 3 years of the Trump administration when they were using tax cuts and relying on deregulation to produce a sort of economic boom. The economic boom was largely in Trump's head, of course. The rate of growth has basically been pretty steady since 2009, as has the rate of employment growth. Now, that's all gone to hell, obviously, with the pandemic, and we've had this enormous economic shock, public health shock. And actually, the Trump administration and Congress, as Republicans always do when they're in charge and there's a crisis, they suddenly discover Keynesianism and big government spending, and they've introduced, along with the Democrats, this $2.2 trillion fiscal stimulus, which is probably only the beginning. As you said in the introduction, there's probably going to be another round, at least one round, possibly two more rounds of stimulus, where the Treasury is just going to be issuing huge amounts of Treasury bonds to finance all this stuff, and the Federal Reserve is backstopping it all. It's a classic sort of Keynesian stimulus policy, although, as I said, in this case, it shouldn't really be thought of as a stimulus policy. It should be thought of as a life support operation.
So economists seem to agree that there should not be a trade-off between saving the economy and saving people's lives, and that significant intervention by the government is absolutely necessary. But there are disagreements about how best to go about it. Grants versus loans, keeping workers on the payroll rather than increasing unemployment benefits. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, there's basically been a transatlantic divide on this one. The basic fact is a lot of people are going to be sent home. A lot of businesses are going to be closing down, at least temporarily. We saw that initially in the retail sector and airlines and hotels, etc. Now we're starting to see it rolling through the rest of the economy. You know, auto manufacturers, other firms which you wouldn't automatically think would be hit, are starting to furlough tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of their workers. So it's starting to ripple through the economy. What do you do about that? One option is just to give them unemployment and say, okay, you can fire anybody you want, and we'll give you generous unemployment insurance benefits for the duration of the crisis, and then you can go back to work. That's basically the initial attitude in this country. The first stimulus package included quite a generous expansion of unemployment benefits. So that was a humane and the right thing to do, because the only reason to keep unemployment benefits under the prevailing wage rate is to encourage people to go back to work. And in this case, we want to encourage them to stay at home. The problem with that is economists wouldn't worry that when the economy eventually starts back up again, a lot of these firms and employees will have lost the sort of employee-firm relationship and they might never take them back on. And a lot of the individual firms themselves might have gone bust. You're damaging the long-term productive potential of the economy by degrading firms and workers, the basic building blocks of the economy. So what they've done in Europe, they started in Denmark and then Britain followed. They basically just said, okay, firms, you can send your workers home, but the government will pay 80, 90% of their wages. So they'll still be employed, but the government will effectively be paying them. Now, the Trump administration is going some way down that track in how it deals with small businesses, firms with under 500 workers. They've launched this business loan plan where banks will extend loans to businesses of under 500 employees. And as long as the firms keep the workers on the payroll, they don't have to repay the loans. So actually, they're not really loans. They're government grants. Question is, why is it better to work through the banking system like that? Or would it have been better to do it directly through the government?
So, and was that largely a political decision?
I think, going back to your earlier question, that was largely an ideological decision. This plan originated from Glenn Hubbard, an economist who worked in the George W. Bush administration, and Michael Strain, an economist at the American Enterprise Institute, Conservative Institute in Washington. I spoke to both of them about the plan, and they both argued that it wasn't really ideological. They said it would work quicker through the banking system because there is no existing government department to pay workers. How would we set that up? Would it be done through the Federal Reserve? Would it be done through the Treasury Department? Would you have to set up an entire new agency? So that was their argument, that it would actually be quicker to work through the banking system. Counter argument to that is that, the banking system seems to be having a lot of trouble getting this up and running too. And I think even though, as I say, they say it was practical, it also feeds into the Republican preference to work through private markets and private industries like the banks rather than setting up a new government department or government bureaucracy or using the IRS to directly support people, because that might establish a dangerous precedent if you're a Republican, right? If the IRS can just start sending people checks, that sounds a bit like a UBI, universal basic income, and I think it's a road Republicans don't want to go down if they can avoid it.
But in the meantime, with 17 million people who have filed for unemployment, it's unfolding as a disaster because the unemployment websites in individual states, including New York, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Florida, have all crashed. And we've seen these scenes in Florida where there have been lines around the blocks as people wait to file for their benefits in person, which is a huge health hazard to all of them.
No, I mean, that's a big problem. The states administer the unemployment insurance system. They're just not set up to deal with this level of claims. I'm told from people who are trying to do it that it's virtually impossible to get through on the phone or on the website to the state unemployment office and file a claim. So what do you do? You have the option of basically sitting at home for a few weeks with no money, which a lot of people obviously can't afford. They've got rents due, etc. Or do you venture out and take your life in your hands and go stand in line down at the local unemployment office and trying to do it that way? So it is a terrible situation. That's another reason why it may have been better in the first instance to try and set up a government direct payment system rather than throwing people out of work. It just inevitably, when you get a shock of this nature, there's going to be a lot of chaos and a lot of human suffering because of it. So Democrats are reacting to this in two or three ways. As you say, there's probably going to be a second stimulus bill. They're talking about pumping a lot more money into the states so they can build up these systems quickly and try and help people quicker. There's also a talk of having a sort of halt on rent payments if you're in trouble. Anything we can do along those lines is essential, and it really needs to be done yesterday rather than waiting for another few weeks, as some of the Republicans are talking about.
And I see that some of the left-wing groups are already highly critical. They don't think the Democratic efforts go far enough, so they've been tough on Pelosi and others who are trying to deal with some of this.
I mean, I think any pressure that can be exerted on the political leadership to get things done quicker is positive, so I'd support that. At the same time, I think you have to realize just the enormous sort of logistical task which we're handing either to a government agency or the banks or whoever. I'm sure the people who are working in local unemployment offices are trying their best to get these claims out. I mean, again, it goes back to, the sort of larger question of how well prepared were we in a public health way, in an economic way, in an administrative way for a crisis of this magnitude.
The American people are getting insanely mixed messages from the Trump administration. Trump said only 2 weeks ago that he wanted the economy opened up and just raring to go by Easter. Easter's, of course, on Sunday. And many states, including red states, are just beginning to feel the effects of the pandemic. So Trump has backed off that deadline. But as we heard from Kudlow, you know, they still want to reopen the economy as quickly as possible. And as Trump says, with a big bang. But at the same time, this morning, we heard Anthony Fauci, the president's chief scientific and health advisor, and a welcome voice of sanity, speak on Today.
Of course, as you can see, the deaths, the number of deaths and the cases that we're seeing right now are really validating what we said, that this is going to be a very bad week on the one hand. But on the other hand, as you can see, there are some glimmers of hope, particularly when you look at the situation in New York, where the number of hospitalizations, requirements for intensive care and intubation over the last few days have actually stabilized and starting to come down. So
John, how should the government begin preparing to reopen the economy? What's the best way to do this?
Well, it's obviously an enormous question. And when you watch the Trump administration, there's always a sort of doubt as to whether Trump is just cheerleading. I mean, he said the other day that my job is basically cheerlead, which would suggest that we should take much of what he says with a pinch of salt, or whether they are really thinking about reopening as soon as possible. I mean, for the moment, which is a good thing, I think the public health experts ultimately seem to be winning out. The question is, if the curves all do start to flatten or start to flatten in places like New York, they've already flattened, obviously, in California and Washington. So there are some encouraging signs, as you said, and as Fauci said. How do you go about reopening even in a limited way? Germany, which has handled this better than almost anywhere else, there's a big new study out of there about how to do this. And they laid down a series of conditions which you needed. One was national, comprehensive, and very effective testing. So you know, in particular areas and neighborhoods, what the infection rate is, and you can follow it very closely if it starts to track back up again. Number two, fully comprehensive health insurance system for everybody, so that if there's a big flare-up in some place, you can quickly go in, provide effective, full care for everybody. Number three, you need effective coordination between the local and the national level. How do you move medical equipment around? How do you surge doctors or whatever into a certain neighborhood? And number four, you need credible and effective leadership, which the public trust, because obviously it's going to be very dangerous experiment. And you can tell people to come back out of home and go to work, but if they think they're going to get the coronavirus once they step out of home, they're not going to do it. So you need all those things. You need testing, you need a comprehensive health system, you need effective coordination between a local and national level, and you need credible leadership. And I think most people, if you're honest, would say, well, we don't have any of those things. So what's the outlook? Well, I think we have to hope that the public health experts, you know, stay in control and they give in a veto effectively on any sort of economic plan. But as time goes on, as the economy gets worse, as maybe the stock market starts going down again, the political, you know, with this is obviously an election on the horizon, the political pressure to get the economy up and going and get the stock market back up is going to get more intense. It's going to be dangerous times, I think, throughout the summer.
He's going to have a hard time using Make America Great Again as his campaign slogan, I would think. But, you know, there's still months
ahead.
I mean,
he's already declaring victory, right? I mean, you know, he's already setting up the WHO and China as the fall guys here. It was their fault, you know.
Well, at the same time, as his voters begin to feel the effects of this.
Well, that's a very good, I mean, obviously that's a very good question. As you were saying, it's starting to spread to rural areas now. Will the voters in these rural areas blame Trump? I mean, I think in terms of economics, it's very hard for me to see how he's going to be able to spin a positive story by the fall. What often happens in an economic catastrophe is you have a first round big economic shock and that feeds through the system and everybody starts laying people off, etc. And then you have a second round, which a financial crisis develops because firms and people all start defaulting on their loans and then you get a financial spiral down. Now, the question is, can the Federal Reserve, which basically is in charge of the financial side of the economy, is what the Fed is doing in terms of basically printing money hand over fist and lending it to anybody in the financial or industrial sector who needs it, is that going to be enough to prevent this sort of financial crisis on top of the immediate public health and economic crisis? They're pumping trillions and trillions of dollars into the financial system, to much bigger than they did in 2008, 2009, to try and keep things afloat until the public health crisis abates. And they probably can do that if the public health crisis abates in reasonable time. But that's why I say everything comes back to the path of the virus. If we get a proper grip on it and it starts to go down in substantial terms, you know, if the ultimate outcome looks more like Asia than what seemed to be an utter catastrophe a couple of weeks ago, we might be able to get through with just a very deep recession. If the public health crisis goes on and on, and maybe we try to reopen the economy somewhere and we get a whole second wave of a mass infection in the fall or whatever, then you're really talking about, you know, an economic catastrophe of the sort we haven't seen before.
Thank you so much, John.
Thank you, Dorothy.
John Cassidy is a staff writer at The New Yorker. He writes a column about politics and economics for NewYorker.com and is the author of How Markets Fail, The Logic of Economic Calamities. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.